All right, our series is The Kingdom of God on Earth. I'll edit all that out, Brother Gary. I'll edit that out in the final broadcast. I won't have to go out over here. But before we get this in sermon audio. Looking today at Lesson 9, Matthew chapter 24, the second coming of the King. Focus verses 1 through 14 of Matthew. Verse 4, our key verse, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. I'll just say in a preamble, one of Jesus' greatest prayers for us about the end time is not so much about our grasp of all the details. I think the details are important. Whatever God says is important. And yet his great concern here and other places in the New Testament is watch for deceivers. People are going to take this subject, the end of the world, eschatology, the doctrine of final things, and there the devil and false teachers are going to just crank out so many deceptions, and people's fears and people's anxieties and people's phobias are going to be accelerated by that, whether it's political events or pandemics, or economic crises. He says, be on guard. People will try to deceive you. They'll take current events and try to frighten you. They'll take current events and try to paralyze you with fear. And says, take heed that no man deceives you. We will observe, and we believe, that Jesus will physically return to this earth. Acts chapter 1, when Jesus ascended back up in the clouds, back to heaven, he had been raised from the dead. He had spent 40 days, Luke and Paul emphasize this, he spent all that time proving that he physically was resurrected, that the resurrection is not a myth. He was not just a spirit or an influence. He was the literal body, glorified, yes, resurrected, yes, but the same Christ who was crucified on the cross, his body is risen from the dead. He took 40 days. Paul emphasizes that sometimes to individuals, often in groups. He points out sometimes 500 people at one time are witnesses, eyewitnesses of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then, as in the purpose of God, Jesus is going to leave, go back to heaven, and send the Holy Spirit to accredit, empower that first church. And so begins the Great Commission era of the gospel with those first Christians in Jerusalem, then Judea, Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. But Jesus ascends up off the earth physically. He doesn't seem to go quickly, but by that I mean he doesn't seem to just vanish. They watch him ascend up into the clouds, and the clouds receive him out of their sight. So they must have watched for a few moments, and they are promised that Jesus will come back in like manner. He will come in the clouds. He will come in the air. 1 Thessalonians 4 tells us about the rapture. More about that perhaps later. Why is it so important to be prepared for Christ's return? Thoughts? Why should you be prepared for Christ's return? I'm going to see him face to face. 1 John calls it our blessed hope. It has a purifying effect on us at waiting for his return. It's a command to be prepared for his return. He tells us many times to watch. So, and then there is the, I hope, there's an affection for Christ. There's a love for Christ. We should long to see him. We should, when someone's been away from us, a loved one, or a friend, we should long to see them. If you have loved ones in heaven, you long to see them. Christ, we should want to be ready to meet him. He tells us, number one, that we should hold worldly treasures loosely. He doesn't say that it's wrong to have worldly treasure. Now, if it's gained wickedly, that wickedness is wrong. But God does prosper us. He gives us richly, often many things to enjoy. Not every Christian enjoys financial prosperity. Some do. You can't judge a man's spirituality by his wealth or the lack thereof. A rich man could be a disciple of Christ. A poor man could be an enemy of Christ. It's not synonymous, like, well, only poor people love Jesus, only poor people follow Jesus. No, but sometimes it does seem that the rich, Jesus warns, have more self-confidence and pride, and that it's hard for a rich man. Why? Because he has to come the same way as the poor man. He has to humble himself. He has to come as a child, and sometimes that's harder for people who have more. But sometimes people who have less can be very proud about their status, or the fact that they are self-made, or they live on a shoestring. They are very proud of that. And so pride can invade the rich and the poor. But anyway, we should hold worldly treasures loosely. We should stay focused through global calamity. Fact of the matter is, we live in a constant state of one kind of global calamity or another. One of the blessings and cursings of the modern era is that we have news access, we have information from all over the globe almost instantaneously. Satellites beam back to us images of flooding in faraway places, or the next state. News reports of famine and problems in Sudan, and then political unrest on the nightly news, the daily news, global calamities all around us. He does also warn us about possibility of tribulation and a plan to proclaim the gospel to the world, verse 14. Verse 1, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. This would be Herod's temple, we call it. Not Herod the Great, who had died when after he had attempted to slaughter the innocents there in Bethlehem. Jesus is taken to Egypt, and then Herod the Great dies. And then Jesus and Mary and Joseph return to Nazareth up in Galilee, and Jesus grows up in Galilee. But this is Herod, one of the descendants, one of the sons of Herod, and he's been building this temple 46 years, the Herod family. The Herodian families have been building a temple, and it was a huge complex. The complex itself was much bigger than Solomon's complex. The temple wasn't as beautiful as Solomon's, but it was big. Herod, the Herodian families, they considered themselves architects and great builders, and they did build some great things. They built down at Caesarea, they built a man-made bay, not a natural bay. They actually built great sea walls for shipping, and Herod's family built some palaces and some fortresses. I believe they built the fortress at Masada, which was the last Jewish redoubt after the destruction of Jerusalem. So the Herodians were quite the builders. And Jesus shows them the buildings, plural, of the temple. It's quite a complex. Jesus said unto them, "See ye not all of these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And these are not pebbles. These are not bricks he's talking about. He's talking about massive boulders, great, huge boulders. And he says they're going to be thrown down. Of course, that would be fulfilled literally in AD 70, when the Romans finally had enough, as they saw it, of this Jewish problem, these constant Jewish revolts and unrest, and they come in AD 70 and they destroy Jerusalem, scatter the Jewish people in the diaspora, the dispersion. So some of the New Testament books like James are written to those scattered Jews, some of whom are believers, but they've called the dispersed. And they did not return as a nation until the late 1940s, after World War II and the Holocaust. Finally, the nations of the world began, at least briefly, to acknowledge the right of Israel to a homeland and began to allow Jews to settle back in Palestine, which had been administered by the British. And then it was divided up. There was a Jordanian kingdom set up for the Arabs. There was the nation of Syria and Lebanon for Arabs. And of course, there's Egypt. And then they carved out this little bitty strip of land on the coast there, nowhere near the size of David's kingdom or Solomon's kingdom. And they gave this little strip of land to the Jews. Well, there's been constant warfare since 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, and then the age of terrorism. Constant barrage of suicide bombers and rocket attacks and constant tunneling on the border of the Israeli border to threaten Israel with destruction. The no nation in the world that I'm aware of deals with the constant threat of extinction that Israel does. I saw one of their politicians just this week mention that when the Jews had no state, people hated them for their religion. When the toleration of religion became more accepted, they would hate the Jews for their race or their ethnicity. Then when it became, quote, unquote, unacceptable to hate people because of their ethnicity, then they hate the Jews because of their political state that they have. Well, all peoples have some inalienable rights to life, liberty, and one of those is to have a state. One of Franklin Roosevelt's four pillars of liberty were that people should be self-directed. Of course, he was talking about democracy or some kind of constitutional republic. People have a right to self-determine their political. And the Jews have a right to exist. We know from the Bible they do have an inheritance there in that promised land. But anyway, the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus prophesied about that coming. And this is a model of Herod's temple as viewed from the northeast, our book says. A full-scale model of some of the temple grounds, they call it. You have the temple proper. The temple proper would be that tall building right there in the center. Then you'd have the courtyards beyond that. And then they had the walls and the rooms. And over to your left, you would have those. Those would be the upper rooms of the storage facilities and meeting rooms. The early Christians would use some of those rooms for their worship services. They were open to the public, I think a little bit like some public parks, you know, first come, first served. I mean, I think some parks allow you to reserve pavilions and so forth, but the early Christians would take advantage of those meeting places because that was not like entering the temple. They didn't have to go into the courtyard, the outer courtyard or the inner courtyard, or into the temple proper. They would just meet in these upper rooms. What is the danger of clinging tightly to worldly treasures? Number one, they're temporary. Number two, you can't hold on to them. You can't hold on to them tightly enough, I guess is what I'm trying to say. In other words, holding tighter doesn't stop them from slipping away. So they're temporary, and you can't control the worldly circumstances. Now, I think an even greater danger is that you begin to trust in them. You begin to think, this is my safety net. This is my protection. This will... I sometimes, at times I'm talking about global calamity and what happens if society begins to fracture, what happens if infrastructure fails. A lot of people remember back in the early days of the shutdown for COVID and going to the grocery store, and there was a lot of panic buying. People didn't know what to expect. That's what happens. It's kind of like Cincinnati and when they predict a snowstorm. In other words, we're very good at this. They predict 6 feet of snow. People rush the store and buy milk and bread. Even people who don't like milk and bread, they think, well, you're supposed to buy milk and bread when snow is coming. But they go and they get, because they think, well, what if we can't get out tomorrow? What if we're, snowbound and, well, we better stock up and get some things. And people started emptying the shelves. In my lifetime, it's one of the few times, the early days of the shutdown, that it was kind of eerie to go into stores that were previously well-stocked. Oh, they might not have your favorite thing, but there's all kind of, but actually bare, empty shelves. And... for some peculiar reason, a run on toilet paper. I don't know how that scare got going, but it did. And people say, well, I'm stocking up because I'm going to have when nobody else has. Here's the problem if society breaks down. I'm not trying to depress you or discourage you. Even if you have food buried in your basement, how long do you think it takes for people to figure out that you got food? Say, well, no one would bother me. I would protect my home. I got it. But how long do you think it will take a mob of people to figure out that you have food hidden in your basement? Or, in other words, when society breaks down, we're not going to be able to say, well, I've got all my stuff hidden in this vault. Well, when the foundations are shaken, You will not be able to hold on to it, not forever, not for long, because the danger of clinging to worldly treasures is they are temporary. You don't have the strength to hold on to them forever. And whether it's the seizure of the mob or the seizure of government, the danger is you'll trust those things. I think of another reason not to hold on too tightly. You can't really enjoy them if you cling to worldly treasure too tightly. The way worldly treasure, with all my worldly treasures, I think I endowed them to Kim when I got married. And that's what you do. And with all my world, what did we say, Ed? We said, with all my worldly goods, I thee endow, or something like that. I'm pretty sure I promised her everything I got. The best way to enjoy your worldly treasures is to share them. Yes, buy what you need, but share them. Give. Giving is one of the best ways to enjoy what God's given you. As God gives us, we give to others, give to His work, give to missions, give to the cause of Christ, give to our family, give to our neighbors, give to people in need. treasures are not meant to be, you know, hidden in the ground, as the parable of the talents Jesus taught. And of course, we think of talents as abilities, but sometimes talents are just talents. They're just money. And the best way is to invest those. That's why the best way to use your money is to invest it, you know, and get a return on it, maybe help other people. You save money, and then people borrow that money, and they buy houses or whatever. That's how it works. So clinging too tightly to world treasures actually robs you of the joy of the treasures you have. Verse 3 says, "And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives," the disciples, very much like you and I, they want to know, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? I've always thought that there are actually three questions the disciples have, and I think this helps you understand some of the answers in chapter 24, because I'm very fond of charts. Jesus, not so much. Jesus doesn't give us a chart. He doesn't give us a picture. The only picture we get of the end times is John on Patmos when he sees those panoramic motion pictures or whatever he saw. Jesus doesn't do a chart. But the disciples, they gather from what Jesus said that there are three things that are going to happen. Number one, the destruction of Jerusalem. And number two, the sign of his coming. And number three, the end of the world. And as it turns out, I believe after watching history and reading history, I still believe those three events are separate events. I happen to know that Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. That is historical fact. The buildings being torn down, the Romans leveling that city, the Jews being scattered. I believe the sign of his coming is separate from his coming and also from the end of the world. Now, as you read through Matthew 24, sometimes Jesus moves back and forth between the destruction of Jerusalem and the sign of his coming and the end of the world. And sometimes, honestly, it's difficult for us to say, is this because some of those events have similarities? For the Jews of that generation, the destruction of Jerusalem was a horrific time. It induced famine. It induced persecution, death, martyrdom, all the things that we associate with maybe the tribulation. A lot of those things, that it was not the end of the world. AD 70 was not the end of the world. You're living proof. You're sitting here right now and you say, I don't think the world ended in AD 70. No, Jerusalem did. Until the restoration began. The sign of his coming, we're going to hear about that in this chapter. And then there's the end of the world. The end of the world is the second coming of Christ, but even that we know is in the rapture phase and the revelation phase. And then there's literally a time when this earth and this universe is going to be melted with fervent heat, Peter says, and there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. So the disciples know there's at least three things he's talking about here: the destruction of Jerusalem, the sign of his coming, and the end of the world. And Jesus, of course, because our key focus there, don't be deceived. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. How many of you have ever heard of wars? Anybody ever heard of rumors of wars? Of course. Constantly. We can all name the great wars, even of the last century. It's like Brother Dewberry was asking the children, and I was surprised, not surprised, but the children were telling him the wars of the last century. They'd learned in history there was World War I, and then there's World War II, and then there's Korea, and then there's Vietnam, and then there's the Cold War, which is a different kind of war, and then there's all kinds of smaller police actions and There's Grenada, there's a Desert Storm, and the century ends. So, and then we're constantly hear about the rumor of war. They might, I grew up listening to rumors about war with the Soviet Union. We had satellite watch towers, not satellite, but radar stations across the distant early line up there in Canada and across the Arctic Circle. We had constant patrol of planes listening for Soviet bombers and watching for Soviet bombers and watching radar for intercontinental ballistic missiles. Remember those ICBMs? That was our lifetime through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. This mutually assured destruction. Was that the political strategy? Does anybody know why Nixon went to China in 1972? Anybody remember Nixon went to China in 1972 and recognized Communist China as the legitimate government of mainland China? Why did he do that? Well, he was trying to triangulate the Russians, the Soviets, from the Chinese. He was trying to see if they got allied together too closely, then we hear about wars and rumors of wars. Jesus' simple advice is don't be troubled. See, is he serious here? War, what could be worse than war? And the rumors upset me. He says, don't be troubled by it. All these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. As a matter of fact, those things are actually characteristic of the age of grace. One of the great blessings of the age of grace is the gospel going to all the world. But at the same time the river of grace is flowing through this age, there is a sewer of corruption flowing just below the surface and bursting out. And wars are nothing more than the national manifestation of greed and lust in an individual's heart. You say, where do these wars come from? James has a very simple answer. He says, you know that lust that you sense in your heart sometimes, that when you want something, you can't have it, and sometimes people want something and they'll steal it, or they'll commit some violent crime to get it, whatever it is. Nations are the same. Nations are just made up of people, and nations say, I want that land, I want that oil, I want that natural resource, I want that waterway, I want access to the Black Sea, to the Suez Canal, I want to control. Every week, is it the 7th Fleet that's in the southeast? Our 7th Fleet, right? Is that where the 7th Fleet is? Bueller? Anyone know? One of those fleets, and they're constantly in the Strait of Formosa. And the Chinese are sailing through the Strait of Formosa. And the Americans are sailing. And they're passing right next to each other in a show of force. And flying sometimes precipitously close to each other. Why are they doing that? Well, we have a right to this waterway, they say. This is a international waters. We're going to sail in. And China says, no, it's ours. And there's a threat of war. And rumors of war, don't be troubled. What about famines? Oh, in parts of Africa, in the Middle East, terrible famines. Terrible famines after natural disasters all over the world. And the tragic thing is that countries who try to send aid, I remember a couple years ago, a natural disaster, hurricanes and so forth in Miramar, and aid from the United Nations, United States, was flew it in, shipped it in, and it rotted on the docks because the government there would not allow anything to be distributed to the people unless it had a government seal and was transported by a government truck. Only problem is they didn't have enough government trains and trucks. They would not allow the Americans or the United Nations to distribute that food to the starving people in the interior because they didn't want them to think that their government... So their government basically let them starve to death. You can say, well, we should have sent some food to them or some aid. We did. And yet their governments forbade them. And sometimes those governments have political agendas, and sometimes they're persecuting ethnic cleansing. They're trying to kill certain groups, and they use the famine for that. They're not interested in alleviating the famines. You think, well, we should do something about that. Well, if we can, and we could, we should, and I think many times we would. Sometimes we can't. We just can't. You could, I suppose, go to war, conquer that country, but then again, we think, wow, what does that entail when you nation build or you destroy a country and take it on to, would you make matter, how many of those citizens would you kill in the war? So it's a very hard thing. And then, of course, there are things that we don't associate with political disaster, like earthquakes, hurricanes, sometimes forest fires are man-made, sometimes forest fires are naturally started by lightning. They're very devastating. Right now the West is in a drought. I think most of the West is in a severe drought. Those are the beginning of sorrows. Here's a picture here of the Mount of Olives, viewed from the city of David across the Kidron Valley. Halfway up there is the Garden of Gethsemane. Jerusalem is a very hilly city, very mountainous. How can you maintain calm during global crisis? Any ideas? Remember that God's on the throne. Remember that God is providentially ruling. You know, it's God who raises up kingdoms and takes down kingdoms. You say, well, sometimes they do very wicked things. Yes, but God can overrule their sin to accomplish his purposes. So remember, God's in control. Another thing to remember is all you can do is all you can do. You can pray and serve and give and love, but you can't control other people. You can't control international communities. The United States, the superpower that it is, doesn't control the other nations. They might influence them, but they can't control them. So trust God and do your duty. Stand by your responsibilities. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Immediately people say, is this about Jerusalem being destroyed, or is this the sign of his coming, or is this the end of the world? Is it tribulation at Jerusalem's fall? Is it tribulation throughout church history? Or is it the great tribulation at the end of the age? And I say, yes. It's really characteristic of all those events. Sometimes Christians in America, we think persecution and tribulation is only something that happens in the 70th week of Daniel. It does happen in the 70th week of Daniel, but don't tell Christians in communist China that there's no tribulation or persecution. They're in prison. Some of them have been killed for their faith. Tell Christians in Muslim-dominant countries, well, don't worry, we're not in the tribulation. They're in a tribulation. They're in a terrible time. And so I think Jesus Jesus is not so much interested in telling you, giving you a chart, and so this is when Jerusalem's destroyed. And he doesn't even tell them that the shortness of that time period. He just says, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Don't be afraid, don't be upset, don't be offended. There may be earthquakes or famines or wars. There may be persecution. Be prepared. And there will be false prophets. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. He blends here the doctrine of perseverance and the doctrine of preservation. How can you prepare to deal with hatred because of your faith? Christians really need to ask this question, because our culture is rapidly shifting toward not just a mistrust of Christians, but a hatred of Christian faith. Because we say that there's only one way to God, and we say that there is an image of God in us that's man and woman, and no more than that. That's considered hate speech. That's considered hostile. That's considered aggressive speech. How can you prepare to deal with hatred because of your faith? Number one, I tell you, remind you of this. Not talking now about political solutions or civil government's responsibilities, but Christians, our responsibility is to love them that hate us. Probably the most unattractive response we could think of. What should I do when people hate me? Love them. Love them that hate you. They hated Jesus. Why would we expect the response to us to be any better than their response to Jesus? So love them back. Don't be surprised when it happens. It doesn't make any logical sense why people should hate Christians. Everywhere Christianity goes, the standard of living goes up, the care of the sick improves, the care of the poor improves. It is the Christians who built the hospitals and the orphanages and the schools. It is Christian influence that taught the West. Those are priorities. You need hospitals, you need schools, you need care for the needy. The protection of women, everywhere Christianity goes, the protection of women and children has gone up. Now, I'm not saying Christians are flawless. I'm not saying the application of Christian principles has been always perfect. But Christian principles do teach us to love others and care for others. Why would people hate a religion of love? In our culture, we're taught to tolerate Islam, which is a religion of hate, and to hate Christianity, which is a religion of love. Is it upside down and backwards? At once, be prepared and proclaim the gospel. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. What should we do? Well, we can't change the flow of history. We can't lasso the hurricanes. We can't undo all the political disasters that depravity creates. But we can share the gospel. Men and women, boys and girls need to hear about Jesus. This is a great joy I had. I preached Tuesday night at camp. And I preached on John 3:16. And one of the great joys is to look into children's eyes. I know nearly all of them have heard this before, but to see them sit there and listen with their hearts open and their minds open and realize I'm telling them, not just me, but we're telling them the only thing that really matters forever. It's the only thing that really matters forever. God loved you, sent his son to die for you. That's the hope. Those little boys and girls, that's the hope of us. That's the hope of the world. And we just need to rest in it. Father, thank you for this morning. There's so many things we don't understand about the future, but you did not see fit to give us details, but you did tell us to trust you and to serve you and preach the gospel till you come. And help us to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.